Yes, let's do it.
Right then, let's go.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercier. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre and television, just about anything, in fact, that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
This week, we're looking at music old and music new. Simon and I spent an evening with the Ultimate Eagles last night, a British bass band playing, not entirely surprisingly, music by the famous American group of a very similar name.
Isn't that something? We've also been listening to the freshly released and long-awaited second album from Lord. It's called Melodrama.
If you're a fan of the British writer and performer Stephen Fry, then you will lap up a movie based on one of his novels, The Hippopotamus.
We both think, though, that you'd have to be an incredibly big fan of Tom Cruise to find much enjoyment at all from his latest outing. It's called The Mummy. But first...
Now that's a wee taste of the Ultimate Eagles, who performed last night at Auckland Town Hall. Now, I don't know about you, Simon, this was the first time I've seen a tribute act.
Same for me. I've got to say, I wasn't sure what to expect, and possibly my expectations were a little low. What were your feelings going into it, Steve?
Well, I'd seen a couple of videos of the band playing, and so I was intrigued. And I'm not the world's biggest Eagles fan. I'm familiar with their work, and I like what I know. I'm not the enthusiast that these six fellas. There's five Brits and an American who are not only very, very accomplished musicians, but clearly they have great affection for the music of the Eagles. And so I didn't really know what to expect, but I know what I came out with. I was very, very impressed.
I've got to say I was too. I when I say my expectations were a little bit low, I'd never seen a tribute band, and I guess I was thinking, am I just going along to see some people just doing some sort of carbon copy of the original? But actually, as they said it themselves and they proved it on stage, they did treat the music with respect and care, and as you say, Steve, they're very experienced musicians, a great deal of skill, and above all, they were absolutely, plainly enjoying what they were doing, and that fed into the audience, and it worked a treat. It really, the fact that these were songs you may have heard on the radio a million times before didn't matter. It's hearing them live which really makes all the difference, and they really did the business.
In fact, I didn't go as far as to say that, yeah, I mean, these are such classic songs, aren't they? You know, Life in the Fast Lane, they played Desperado, Heartache Tonight, Tequila Sunrise. I mean, this was basically a greatest hits of the Eagles. So these are all songs that we know. I mean, those songs I'd forgotten that I knew.
Yes.
And they were a joy to hear, though.
They were a joy to hear. We should talk just a little bit about this band. There's, as you say, six of them. Many of them, at least three of them, were doing lead vocals.
Yes.
They were swapping and changing on the keyboards. Three of them at different times played the keyboards. The two lead guitarists bounced off each other very, very well. And the most important thing, I guess, is the vocals. How close to the Eagles did they capture the essence of what the Eagles were about and their harmony and their delivery? And in that score, I think they did really, really well.
They did, didn't they? There was Danny Vaughan, who's the only American in the band, was the front man. And he was fantastic, a superb voice that really... I don't think it was meant to be an imitation. I think we need to be careful about what we're talking about here. It wasn't imitating the Eagles especially, but what he was doing was he was tapping into what an Eagles song is.
Yes, I agree with that. And he and perhaps the other main vocalist, Michael Lawrence... Again, his voice was not necessarily by any means a voice trying to imitate any of the Eagles singers. But he had a very expressive voice, a powerful voice. They all did, and he was interpreting the songs in a very meaningful way. And I think that translated across the audience, who really enjoyed it. So it's about hearing something live, in fact, and that's why it worked, wasn't it?
Yeah, because let's face it, we're never going to see the Eagles live ever again.
Not now, no.
For fairly obvious reasons.
Yes, yes.
So, and if you want to see these songs played basically with the skill that you'd expect from an Eagles show, I mean, Chris Wright on slide guitar, I thought, was phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree. He was very, very good. He was also the group's musical director, I noted, when they were doing the introductions.
And yes,
he was excellent.
Andy Jones crunched out some magnificent solos with fluidity and expressiveness like I've not heard on a guitar player in some time. They were an amazing band, and I was most impressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, look, afterwards they I must tell you something, Steve.
Yep.
Afterwards they hang around a little bit to talk to a few people, and these guys have been touring Australia. Last night at the Auckland Town Hall was the last show of this tour, and they're going back to Europe. They only flew in that day,
to
Auckland. They had very little sleep, so it was a tribute to their professionalism that they'd put on a show like that, and it worked very, very well. In fact, they got stronger, I thought, as the set went along. I thought that the performance improved. They started high but got better. And I think the thing I take away from it is that a tribute band is perhaps, it's a good name and it's not a good name. It might conjure up a slightly image of someone just trying to imitate, but it's not about imitation. It is about genuinely paying tribute.
Yes.
To someone else's skill, to someone else's music that means something to you. It means something to the band, and that's why you'd have a good night out. Now, I spoke afterwards, Steve, to the aforementioned Danny Bourne, the lead singer. He has very long black hair.
Indeed.
And I had caught up with him, asked him a little bit about the band and why it is they're so attracted to the Eagles and why they're treating this music with such respect. Here's what he had to say.
Well, I mean, it's in all our histories. You know, I mean, I grew up in America, so it was everywhere, always, all my life. You know, shopping malls, you know, passing cars, still is. I went out to Vegas 2 years ago, and every casino you walked into, and take it easy. It's just, you know, it's just synonymous with America. And that's why I'm so impressed at how far that music's gone. You know, they have tons and tons of fans in China and, you know, places you think, how is this coming across? How are people getting the vibe of this music?
Because it is so American, so very rooted in America.
Yeah, I think they're pretty much the quintessential American band because, you know, they were the first band to do what is now called crossover. You know, they were on the country charts, they were on the pop charts, they were on the rock charts, and nobody gave them a hard time for, you know, writing Peaceful, Easy Feeling next to Life in the Fast Lane. You know, it didn't bother anybody. So.
And tell me about taking the hits that everyone knows and playing them night after night. How do you make sure that every night it's a special performance for those people out there watching you?
Well, the specialness comes from them. Our job is to, and it never stops, by the way, our job is to constantly review and see how can we present as much of the album sound as we can. I mean, because let's face it, some of these tracks have, you know, 18 guitar tracks. We don't have an orchestra. We can't afford it. So how do you maximize what you've got? And there's always discussions about harmonies. I mean, the main thing is the vocals, yeah. Obviously. You know, we work really hard on everybody singing. And so I think making it special is just, it's really up to, it's what I call the circle. You know, I mean, we're going to come out and do our job in hopes. And some audiences will sit there with their arms crossed and their attitude is, well, you've flown a pretty high flag, best impress us. Some people come out to have a great time, which you guys did tonight. And that, to me, changes the vibe of the show. It really does. And all of a sudden, you know, you see the smile start to light up. It's like, okay, all we've got to do is play well now and they're ready. You know, and that makes, that ups the show for all of us.
Have you guys actually met the Eagles?
No. Everyone asks that. That's so funny. No, I'm not sure I want to. I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah, fair enough. What's your favorite song, Eagles song?
I don't have a favorite song per se. I'll have a favorite song in a tour. I'll have a favorite song of the week. It changes around. One of my very favorites to perform is Pretty Maids All in a Row. I just adore that harmony structure. And I think one of the key things about doing this is that it's really not about, you know, everybody gets their solos and all that. It's an ensemble.
Mm.
And songs like that truly illustrate that, you know, because it's almost, it's so understated. It's like what I said tonight. It's almost hard to believe that's Joe Walsh. But he has that ability to write some of the most heart-wrenching songs, Help Me Make It Through the Night, things like that, which we've also performed.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's something about that that I think, to me, shows off the real subtlety of the ensemble. So I really enjoy performing that one.
And one last thing, and you mentioned it in the concert tonight, the importance of word of mouth on social media to get to build support. How important has that been already to get you where you've got to?
It's the most important thing. There's no question about it. When first of all, in the UK, there are a fair few number of Eagles tribute bands. So we come along and say, okay, what's so special about you? Well, in my opinion, we're the best ones. But how do I convince you of that? And, you know, so like I say, you get a bit brazen. You know, our mission statement is we want to play these songs better than anyone except the Eagles themselves. And that's how it started out. So the word of mouth became hugely important, you know, with the internet, because convincing theaters to take you on, it's a lot of money has to change hands for all this to work. As you can see, it's a lot of guitars, it's a lot of gear. It's not a three-piece show that somebody forks out 500 quid for. So we've got to make it work. And the response, you know, it's been cycling bigger and bigger. So the first year we just did UK shows. The second year we did UK, we did three shows in Amsterdam. And then it took off for us in Holland. And then it took off for us in Germany. We're going into France this year. It took off for us in Belgium. You know, and there's been some other places as well. We've been to India.
Have you?
Yeah, it was just a one-off. It was an amazing thing. But, you know, and then this call came in to do this, and it was just everything we'd wanted, you know, to try and make it as international as possible.
Well, thank you very much. We really enjoyed it. Fantastic.
I could tell, and that, like I said, that was right to the heart. It was fantastic.
And by the way, Steve, I think you've got one or two photos we're going to put on the website as well. So if you want to get a bit of a sense of what was going on the stage last night.
Yes, so we'll also have a link to a YouTube video of a rather impressive reading of Hotel California.
Excellent.
Takes some nerve to play that song live, and I'd say they did a remarkable job of it.
Very, very good. Yep. So if they do come back, and if you do like the Eagles, highly recommended.
Absolutely. Now to more music, and possibly the most anticipated album of the year, certainly the most anticipated album of the year in New Zealand. This is obviously Lord's follow-up to a hugely successful debut album, Pure Heroine, which came out back in the 1700s, I think it was.
Yes,
it feels like it's been that long, doesn't it? With the anticipation that we're dealing with melodrama. Such an ironically titled album, isn't it?
Yes,
And we've been both having a bit of a listen because, you know, obviously it is the album of the moment. So, Simon.
Yeah, well, look, have to say, on first listen, and now I've had a chance to listen back two or three times, I think it's a really strong album, and I think you should treat it as an album of a whole work, not just a little mishmash of individual songs. It is, as I think has been written about for some time now, an album based a lot around her personal experience of a relationship breaking up, and so you have an essay on that, if you like, a musical essay on that. So there's a theme there that carries right through. It's, I think she's a good writer of lyrics. I find her writing quite insightful at times, a little wry and humorous at times. Not too full of a young person's, I was going to say teenager, she's just turned 20. not too full of a young person's angst. There's a bit of that, but there's also a bit of reflection from a distance, a bit of perspective, which I thought was quite mature. And the music is, I don't know how you would treat it, Steve. It's not the music that would necessarily I would immediately be drawn to, but it's very well produced. It's got a lot of that sort of modern pop, you know, synth, keyboard, bass and drum-driven music, but and not perhaps full of catchy, globally smash hit singles, maybe, but it's growing on me, and I think there's some serious quality in what's been produced here. That's my first take on it.
Well, see, I think the way that you structured your comments is very, very telling.
Okay.
And I think it aligns both with the review that you got on our website at cravepodcast.com and that lesser reviews are available from other sources as well. But they tally. You talked about her lyrics. And you talked about how she's got very wry observations, and you talked about it's about her breakup, and it's about this, and the music as well. And it occurs to me that the music is almost secondary. The lyric writing is strong. There is no doubt about it. She is a profound observer and astute lyricist.
Yeah,
precocious, way beyond her years. she definitely escapes the trap that others of more maturity fall into, which is being twee and pretentious and climbing up themselves. She's got a very strong writing talent. The music, I don't think, is there. It's produced to within an inch of its life. She does the producer does that thing for her of cranking up the compression so high that you can hear every last rasp of her breath. But and the arrangements are sparse beyond belief. It makes Royals sound muddy and swampy in comparison. But the music itself is not really there, in my opinion. There's not the focus is very much on the experience. With the exception of Green Light, which is the only real single, in my opinion, on the album, it's not really music to listen to.
Ooh, okay. Well, I think we're going to disagree on that, but that's okay. I think Green Light is a good single. I thought Supercut towards the end of the track list was quite a strong single. And I think some of the other songs, one thing I thought actually as you go through the album, the songs do blend into each other, and there is
so
I think that, but I kind of, for me, that felt like that was intentional. A couple of the ballads I thought were strong. I liked Writer in the Dark, and I thought Liability was pretty strong too. But I agree with you. I don't think it's not an album full of catchy hooks of melody, but you mentioned the compression on her voice. The fact when you listen to this, her voice is very much in the center of your hearing, and you are hearing her, as you say, the intake of her breath and the rasp of her voice. To me, that just made it all the more personal, and I thought that fitted what she was trying to do with it. It's not. I've listened to it two or three times now. I'm still absorbing it to a certain extent. I'm still enjoying it, Steve. We'll just agree to disagree a little bit on the music, because it's such a thematic piece. The fact that the music maybe isn't immediately catchy didn't worry me so much. But anyway, it's all good.
Yeah, well, we'll have another chance to revisit this material in a few months' time.
Anna, just remind me about that.
Well, in November, she's touring.
Ah, yes, and that's right. And she's decided, I think, certainly in Auckland, to play some smaller venues, which is interesting.
Yes, it's a rather surprising tour, to be honest, because last time she played, a few years ago, she played at, what are we calling it these days? It was the Vector Arena back then, wasn't it?
Spark, that's right, Spark.
Spark Arena this week. But this time round, she's playing a much, much smaller set of venues. I'm just trying to find the information on our website right now. This is less professional than it might possibly be. but yeah, she's playing three nights at the Power Station.
Okay.
In Auckland, which is surprising, because that's not going to. I mean, three nights there is not going to match one single night at the arena, obviously.
Yes.
She's doing Town Hall in Dunedin. She's doing two nights now. They've announced a second night at the Isaac Theatre Royal in Christchurch, and she's also doing the Michael Fowler Centre in Wellington. But then three nights, Sunday, Tuesday and Wednesday, 12th, 14th and 15th of November, in the Power Station in Auckland.
Yes. So actually, that's the point, Steve. You know, it possibly suggests, among other things, she's looking for a more intimate setting, but she probably doesn't have to fill out an arena for any financial reasons.
No, she's probably not strapped for cash right now. She's no. ferociously and deservedly, to be fair, successful performer. And I think you're right. I would imagine that a lot of those songs will get lost in an arena.
Yes.
I think the Power Station or venues of that ilk will make for a very, very, very powerful performance.
Yeah. And just on that, you know, you talked about being produced within an inch of its life. I mean, this album was recorded in three, I think I counted, American studios, was mixed in another studio in another state. It was all sort of produced over a period of, I think, a year, living in the States. So a lot of effort and thought has gone into it. So you're dealing with this is not a rushed piece of work.
No, she's definitely taken her time and crafted something here, very definitely.
Yeah.
Live in the studio is not a recording modality she embraces, I don't think.
Not yet, anyway. Okay. Steve, anyway, so I think, given what Steve's got to say, it's still worth having a listen to what I think you'd say is an important artist for this country anyway right now, and to see what you think of Melodrama from Lorde, her second album.
Oh, very definitely. It's very definitely an important album. I'll give you that one.
The day you kissed a rider in the dark. Now she's gonna play and sing and lock you in her heart. Bet you the day you kissed a rider in the dark. I am my mother's child. I love you till my breathing stops. I love you till you call the cops on me.
All right, now, hey, let's get on to some movies, Steve. We've had a bit of time, apart from listening to music, to catch a film here and there. I can't wait for us both to dive headlong into the world of Tom Cruise. But just before we get there, tell me about Stephen Fry and Hippopotamus.
Well, The Hippopotamus was one of Stephen Fry's novels. He's written quite a few over the years. And I don't know necessarily this was the best choice for a film adaptation. I mean, to be fair, some of his other ones would have been more difficult to adapt for the screen. But the story basically is... We start with a washed up, in many senses, theatre critic named Ted Wallace, played beautifully by Roger Allam. And he's basically blotted his copybook by hurling abuse during a production of Julius Caesar and fired by his editor. And next thing you know, he's being contacted by a young woman by the name of Jane, who wants him to go to basically sort of an ancestral home belonging to her relatives, Swafford Hall, where something is afoot. And we're not told; she's not really telling him what it is, but it turns out that there appear to be miracles happening there, and he wants her to go and investigate. And that's how the story plays out from there. And
okay.
So you have, as I say, Roger Allam as Ted. You've got Emily Barrington as Jane, who doesn't really appear too much after the setup, really. Matthew Modine, the American actor, as the paterfamilias.
Right.
And various lesser actors as the family. And frankly, overblown, scenery-chewing turn from Tim McInerney, late of the Blackadder series, another house guest who's hoping to enjoy one of the Swafford miracles. And the only thing you really need to know about this film is the fact that it's a Stephen Fry adaptation.
Right.
So if you took several thousand kilograms of Stephen Fry and put them in a great big cauldron and boiled them down and got essence of Stephen Fry, distilled essence of Stephen Fry, imagine like Stephen Fry Marmite and spread it on some toast.
Yes.
That's what you'd have in this film.
Not sure if I want to imagine that, but yes, all right, I'm getting the picture. Thank you.
A lot of the film is told in voiceover as Ted Wallace narrates the film. And it's obviously lifted directly from first-person narration in the novel. But after a while, I am a Stephen Fry fan. I think what he does is brilliant much of the time. It starts to feel a little bit rich after a while. The story is fairly straightforward. There's a not entirely surprising twist, especially if you're familiar with Stephen Fry. You'll know where he's headed with it from fairly early on, and the way he gets there is reasonably entertaining. It's a very straightforwardly put together film, but while Roger Allam has that wonderful, rich, deep, fruity voice that lends itself to the very arch, very tart, very crisp and knowing kind of comments that only Stephen Fry could churn out in commercial quantities. After a while, I'm not sure that it holds up, to be honest. And I went into this film looking forward to it, knowing I was going to enjoy it. Right. But after a while, I'm thinking, okay, it's a little bit one note.
Yes.
It's a little bit too arch. And as I say, Tim McKinney in particular starts to descend very, very slightly into caricature. If you are a Stephen Fry fan, go and see it. You'll enjoy it. You'll know exactly what you're going to get and you'll embrace it. You get Stephen Fry, basically.
All right. Well, for a lot of people, that'll be reason enough to hit along. Thanks.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that is Hippopotamus. Steve, one thing we both saw, and I gather from reading your website review, and if you've seen mine, I think we both agree on this one. Neither of us were particularly jumping for joy over Tom Cruise's latest offering called The Mummy.
Well, you wouldn't, would you? Because it was rubbish.
I love it when you get to the point. Well, it was. It was extremely disappointing. In my web review, I just said, the kitchen sink was applied, but to no avail. And it was very disappointing. Whenever time we talk about Tom Cruise, don't we, Steve? We're talking about a Tom Cruise vehicle for a movie. He essentially isn't going to give you much different from film to film. I think there have actually been one or two which I've enjoyed. But this one, just tried to put everything into it. It's extremely muddled. I laughed sometimes when I don't think I was meant to. That's never a good sign.
There was an awful lot of "you've got to be kidding me" going on.
And it's almost not worth talking about the plot, really. It's The Mummy. So do you need to say anything more than that?
Well, yes, there wasn't an actual mummy in it.
Not in the traditional sense. No, correct.
She was never mummified. I mean, I know I'm being a pedant here. And really, if you start paying attention to details, like one little one I mentioned on my web review was the fact that when you got a plane with four engines and the captain calls out, "We've lost both engines." someone's just being lazy here. I mean, are we even going to bother attempt doing the plot?
I don't think we should do too much, but we have to say a little bit about it because it involves some of the characters that we need to just very briefly discuss. So the film starts off with a voiceover from Russell Crowe, doesn't it? Which
yes,
gives
it
you
does.
A little bit of history of this particular mummy, who is or mummy to be.
Oh dear.
And she is Amenet, the Egyptian princess Amenet. She had been embalmed centuries ago because she was going to inherit the throne, didn't, and in an attempt to gain power, she tried to seal a pact with the Egyptian god of death called Set. This all goes wrong. She's buried alive. And then we skip forward a few centuries to Tom Cruise and a mate of his running around the Iraqi desert. They're soldiers, they're soldiers on the make, and they're trying to pilfer artifacts to earn a good dollar on the side. So that's the setup for the film, isn't it?
That's about it. And to be fair, director Alex Kurtzman didn't put a whole lot of effort into the plot, so I don't see why we should.
No. So basically, Russell Crowe's character, who is, and do we need to say his name? We do. It is. I'll let you say it.
Dr. Henry Jekyll.
Yes, Jekyll. So how he gets into the story, I don't know. What were they thinking on that one? I have no idea. But anyway, Jekyll and a colleague called Jenny, who's the one who ends up being Tom Cruise's sidekick, their paths cross over what happens to the Egyptian princess when they discover her sarcophagus in the modern day. And, well, that's probably all we need to say. But it's extremely muddled. There's all sorts of things being thrown into it. The usual things, aren't they? You know, there are some things you're going to get with Tom Cruise, don't you, Steve? You know you're going to get some stunts.
Oh, yes.
You're going to see him run. You're going to see him jump. You're going to see him get in a fight.
He took his shirt off.
Took his shirt off, yes. Yeah, he's still looking pretty fit, it's got to be said.
Yeah, but we're working through a checklist here, basically, aren't we?
Yeah.
And so basically, I mean, it's Tom Cruise as Tom Cruise, really, isn't it?
It pretty much is. There's just that I was thinking about this. There is a slight variation he does. I saw a film of his a few years back. It was a sci-fi with that very accomplished English actress, Emily Blunt.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Edge of Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
And in that one, he played a character who wasn't entirely heroic.
Ooh.
And it was slightly he becomes the hero, but he just doesn't start off as one. He's slightly a bit of a bumbling sort of a character. And in this film, he starts off as not necessarily the most the purest of heroes. It evolves as the film goes on. I thought he was trying to be to do things a little differently, but he can't really. He's Tom Cruise. That's all.
There's one moment, one of the few bits of where his character's in genuine peril.
Yeah.
And there's a close-up on his face. And I thought it just showed in the cruelest, starkest relief the limitations of his acting skills. He looked almost like he was doing slapstick when he was meant to be scared. He's not a gifted actor. He's got one role that he's carved out for himself. This sort of like slightly charming action character.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like he would have loved to have been an American equivalent of James Bond had such a role existed.
Yes.
And that's it. That's what he does. And when he can find a film he can shoehorn that into, he can make it work. But that's it. Once you take him sort of like, you know, off the reservation, he loses it.
Yes.
And you end up with, as you say, a muddled mess of a film. There were so many things in this film that made no sense. I mean, first of all, you mentioned the Egyptian god of death, Set. My friend Andrea, who's an Egyptologist, did point out that the god of death was in fact Osiris. There's so many things that just didn't add up. Like I say, she was never a mummy. She was simply buried alive in bandages.
Yeah.
Doesn't make you a mummy.
Yeah. No, okay.
What's the thing with the extra pupil in the eyeball?
I've no idea.
Thank you very much. I thought I'd missed something.
No.
But it's clearly significant because that's one of the images on the poster.
Yes.
But they make no attempt to explain what's going on.
Yeah. In the audience, I watched it with Steve. There were some moments of laughter, I think, in response to a genuine attempt at humour. But there were other moments when people were, I have to say, almost cringing. And I can't help but mention Russell Crowe again. If you're going to call someone Dr. Jekyll, that suggests there will be a transformation of some type in the story, and there is. And I started laughing. I'm sorry, I did. When that transformation to Mr. Hyde took place, I just thought, you're joking, aren't you? This was farcical.
Well, it was wasted. Jekyll and Hyde has to be a headline act. You can't make, especially when Russell Crowe's doing it, you can't make that the supporting act.
Yeah, it just felt very confused and not at all focused, and perhaps the thing that at the end of it, it's quite clear that Tom is looking in the character he's created, who just to remind ourselves is called Nick Morton. I'm sure he's thinking this guy's going to be the next long-running franchise like a la Mission Impossible. I don't know whether the audiences are going to buy this. I think so far, Steve, this is not done very well for him commercially, shall we say.
Well, from what I can tell, we are not the first people to give it a less than glowing review.
I think that might be the case, yes.
Yeah, I mean, this apparently is supposedly part of the groundbreaking for the Universal's Dark Universe, which is an awfully clunky and borderline tautological title for a franchise.
Right.
But this is supposedly the latest in these comic book universes that are now all the rage.
In
the picture houses of the world. And if this is Universal setting out their stall, they can pack it up and go home for me.
Yeah, I'd join you in that packing. I think so. Yeah. So look, you'd have to if you are a real fan of Cruise, I guess you'll have the odd moment of admiring of his stunts and his fitness and all that sort of thing. But really, there are other better produced, better thought out adventure films out there at the moment.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Definitely.
Phew! All right, Steve, that's us. We've talked about music and film. Anything else really, really significant coming up in either genre in the next little while? I think there are a few other sort of blockbuster type films just around the corner, a la the next Planet of the Apes is just around the corner, and another Transformers movie.
Despicable Me 3 opens in a couple of weeks. Well, there is. Yeah, I mean, look, we can wallow in the fact that every film coming up very shortly has got a number in the title.
Yes, yes.
Which you can probably tell from the tone of my voice does not set my young heart aflame. But there's one that will be getting reviewed in the next episode of Crave.
Yes.
The Journey. We won't say too much about that one right now.
Ah, yes, yes.
But that's a little bit special.
It is. We both got some very, very interesting things to say about The Journey next time. Okay. Yeah, so quite a few movies to talk about soon. What about music, Steve?
Well, there's actually been one or two announcements in the last couple of weeks since we spoke last. The Vamps, who are one of Britain's main sort of pop rock bands, if you'd like, are looking good. They're coming to the Power Station on the 23rd of September.
Okay.
It's going to be good. Boney M, we've talked about at great length.
Yes.
We now have photographs from their Auckland show on our website.
Yes, then, excellent.
London Grammar, shoegazers par excellence, are going to be coming to, surprisingly, Spark Arena. I wouldn't have thought they'd be big enough. The sound was right for that, but they're a big band, so they'll be playing at Spark Arena on the 30th of September.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see who else we've got coming up, because there's been a few decent announcements. Lionel Richie and Chic featuring Nile Rodgers.
Ooh.
Now we're going back a wee bit.
We are indeed.
Now only Spark Arena or Horncastle Arena in Christchurch have ceilings big enough for Lionel to dance on. See what I did there, yeah?
Oh, lovely. Lovely work, my son.
19th and 21st of October there for those two. What else have we got? There's a couple more. We've already talked about Lord.
Yes.
Lordy, Lordy, that's going to be a big one.
It will.
And then there's just one more very, very, very big one to announce. This one's for February of next year.
Yes.
Queen.
Oh.
Yes, I thought that'd get your attention.
Well,
Queen plus Adam Lambert.
Oh, I was going to ask you who was going to be. It is Adam Lambert. Okay.
It is
okay.
Adam Lambert. Now, I have to go to this one because last time I saw Adam Lambert, I wrote a review for another outlet. But while the comments stopped short of death threats, they came pretty bloody close. Because I had the temerity to suggest that he's better suited to a big arena show than playing the Town Hall. I'm told that the Queen and Adam Lambert show is outstanding, astonishing and brilliant. I mean, let's face it, with a back catalogue like those guys have got, how can it fail to be?
And where are they playing?
That's also going to be Spark Arena, Saturday the 17th of February next year.
Right, right. Okay. I suspect they will fill that place out.
I know one seat that will definitely be filled.
Okay, excellent. All right, good stuff. Lots of good entertainment coming up. Thank you for listening to us, Steve and I. We would like to hear from you. If you've got anything to say to us, you can email us. podcast@cravepodcast.com is the way to do it.
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @cravepodcast.
Excellent. So, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe. And this week, we're going to leave you with something a little bit different. This is Hotel California by the Ultimate Eagles.
Yeah! Woo!